This is a recording of a sermon given at the First Unitarian Church of St. Louis.
It's lovely. Everyone needs love. But some need punishment. Universalism, I'll have you know, universalism in Christianity, which is the idea at the bare minimum that God is capable of saving all souls, and at its most is a firm confidence that God will save all souls. Universalism was prominent in the first 500 years of Christianity. The first theologian, systematic theologian of Christianity, Origen, lived from about 185 to 254, in his most important theological work on first principles, said, "We assert that the Word, who is the wisdom of God, shall bring together all intelligent creatures and convert them into his own perfection through the instrumentality of their free will and of their own exertion." And in the beginning of America, from the last two decades of the 18th century and into the first half of the 19th century, universalism was a prosperous and large denomination, one of the largest in America. When Unitarians and Universalists came together and consolidated in 1961, you may know that the most common fear amongst the Universalists was that they would be swallowed up. They were a very small group compared to the Unitarians, and there was an anxiety about Universalism being lost. Of course, the most common concern of Unitarians at the time of that consolidation was that they would get indigestion. But in fact, Universalism was always larger in terms of numbers. There were significant names and well-known names within Unitarianism, and the Unitarian Association of America has always produced people of significant power and character. But Universalists also were people of character, and there were more of them in America for many years. There were a couple things that ended up weakening Universalism. The first was that their grand enemy, which was Predestinarian Calvinism. Predestinarian Calvinism is that idea that some people, that all of us, are born with a particular destiny, a destiny either to hell or to heaven, and that destiny is irreconcilable and unmovable and eternal. That idea that some of us are unworthy and will show our unworthiness as our life goes on, and others of us are worthy, others of us are special. That idea that some of us will be saved and others of us will not. That confidence that people look for, the desire to find that affirmation that we're amongst the lucky ones who are going to be saved. That kind of theology was the great enemy of universalism, the great enemy of democracy. It undermines the basic principles of a democratic country, and universalism fought against it until it basically won. In America, it weakened that really rigid predestinarian Calvinism to the point that it kind of got pushed off. Even the Presbyterians moved it back into the closet and began to talk more about good works and about tolerance of diversity and about acceptance of one another. There was a broad mainline Christianity that was much less about feeling superior and much more about trying to get along with people. The second thing that really hurt Universalism was the Civil War. Doctrine that was built upon confidence in the goodness of human beings, in the capability of human beings to learn and to reconcile with one another, to grow in love and the power of love. A doctrine that was built on the idea that love was the greatest power and love would overcome all things in the end was severely harmed by the horrors and the terrors of a war of a nation that was split in half and people killing one another's cousins and brothers in violent battle. And the third thing that weakened Universalism was a confusion about the role of punishment, about the nature of judgment. There's a tendency for those who affirm a universalist doctrine, who talk about reconciliation, who talk about healing, to focus so much on goodness and love and kindness that they forget the importance of judgment. Those universalist theologians who had great power when universalism was of its greatest strength, it always affirmed the importance of judging people's actions, that there was an ultimate judgment on people's actions, on the consequences of our actions, and there had to be some bad consequences in life. It was clear that some people suffered more than others, that victims were often the larger bearer of the bad consequences of people's bad actions, would suffer more internally. But the point was that there was suffering, and there was division, and there was hatred, and there was fear, and there was anxiety in this world by evil actions, by sinful acts, that there was a serious consequence, the feeling of division, of hurt and harm, living in human beings and in human hearts. And that would echo out into the eternal, into the afterlife. There was a very strong belief amongst most Christians, a majority of Christians in the early time of Christianity, and among universalists, that there would have to be some moment of correction. That correction was necessary, that correction was needed, that judgment was required. But the purpose always was to lead people towards wholeness and towards reconciliation, not towards revenge. In the story of Coyote and Rabbit, Rabbit at first is trying to get some sort of vengeance. He's trying to be mean. He's trying to return evil for evil, and that never heals the world. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, as the saying goes, leaves the whole world blind and toothless. Our theology is one of inclusion, including all human beings in community and affirming that connectedness. And in that connectedness, there must be some understanding of those who cause harm, some response. The comedian Harry Hill said, "I was bullied at school. I was called all kinds of different names. But one day I turned to my bullies and I said, 'Sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me.' And it worked. From there on out, it was sticks and stones all the way." He did not correct their behavior. He only altered their behavior in a more difficult path. Dostoevsky, in his book, The Brothers Karamazov, notes at one point that schoolboys are a merciless race. Individually, they're angels, but together, especially in schools, they are often merciless. There is something within the human heart, something within the human nature where we are willing to engage and cruel behavior towards one another, whether it is bullying or warfare. There was a woman named Eugene Miriam, and she wrote, "Most bullies are the product of a stressful and often abusive home life." Reflecting on the causes of violence within human community, and she said, "The next time that a bully threatens or attacks you, just yell, 'Don't abuse me like your parents abused you.' Then call children's services and tell them you saw this bully crying in the bathroom and you're worried about him, and bam, he'll just get moved off to a foster home and you won't have to deal with him anymore." We want to be understanding. We want to change people's behavior. But often, when we realize our own errors, we claim the possibility of change and growth and forgiveness. And when we see the errors of other people, we want only revenge. We want only harm to come to that person. I was reading a Christian book the other day, and one of the Quaker writer, said, "When I realized my own deep sinfulness, I claimed, 'God is merciful, and I am forgiven.' But whenever others have sinned against me, I proclaim, 'God is angry, and you're going to be sorry.'" Always, there is this tension about punishment. When people hurt us, we want to strike back. We want to harm them. It is a very natural, easy way of being human. But there is a much more powerful way of responding, which is the desire to correct and redirect. Hosea Ballou, in his theology, always emphasized how the doctrine of an eternal hell not only caused bad consequences for us, made us meaner, made us more willing to harm others, made us more willing to be judgmental and harsh to others, to be punishing to others, but it also ruined God's character. God, instead of being the source of love, God is love. When those who love know God and experience God, all those phrases suddenly were demolished when you began to think of this very harsh and punishing God whose only goal was to harm people and to harm them eternally. It was a ruination of the whole concept for him of God. It was a ruination of the idea of a father and a parent. He saw Hosea Ballou emphasize that Jesus had seen God as the loving father, not as a cruel and vindictive and hurtful father. So there's a book called If Grace is True by two Christian theologians, Gully and Mulholland. And they tell a story in it. They tell a story about a father who was irritated at his two sons who were always fighting, bickering, fighting. And one day his son Dan came in and said that Mike had hit him. "Do something, Dad." So the father put them together in the same room and he told Dan, "You can now hit Mike back and he can't hit you." Well, Dan was still angry, still feeling hurt about being hit, so he punched his brother. And when his brother started crying, he started crying too. The both of them were sobbing in misery. And the father realized, he said, "Suddenly I realized that I had failed my boys. Mike had come to seeking my help in healing the breach between his brother and him. He wanted them to be able to play together peacefully. He wanted reconciliation, and all I gave him was revenge." The ideal parent is not simply trying to create revenge and cause harm for harm's sake, but to nurture forgiveness and healing and reconciliation, to teach a child. Love and punishment are not mutually exclusive, but parental punishment should never be designed to inflict pain. Too many parents are angry, and in the moment of the anger, they express their anger. This is not an ideal way to be. It is not a healing way to me. It is not a beautiful way to be. Love and punishment are not mutually exclusive, but parental punishment always is designed to redeem, to shape, to direct, or to protect. And this is the ideal within Universalist Christianity, the idea that any punishment, any harm, should teach us how to come closer towards justice and peace and well-being with one another. There was a report released on April 18th, 2012, that I found rather striking. I have long been an opponent of the death penalty for these very reasons. You cannot communicate that it is wrong to murder someone by murdering someone, by killing them, however justly and however fairly. And I struggle to find, and I wish that I could tell you, that those societies that have the death penalty tend to be more violent. It's my general perception that that's true. But in 2012, the National Research Council and the National Academies did a review of more than three decades of research on the death penalty, and they concluded that studies claiming any deterrent effect on murder rates from the death penalty were fundamentally flawed, but also those that tried to prove the death penalty was somehow corrosive to a society. And they concluded, research to date on the effect of capital punishment on homicide is not informative about whether capital punishment decreases, increases, or has no effect on homicidal rates. And a criminologist, Daniel Nagin of the Carnegie Mellon, said, we recognize this conclusion will be controversial to some, but nobody is well served by unfounded claims about the death penalty. Nothing is known about how potential murderers actually perceive their risk of punishment. Perhaps it is impossible to know. But what we do know is the social consequences of a system in which some people are left out. It is very clear and consistent that when you know there are some people who are not equal to you, there are some people who are lesser in your society, people who can be treated poorly, people who can be kept in low jobs, who can be prevented from having opportunity of economic advancement, any society or system that says some of you are destined to be lower and others are destined to be higher, that society always has a corrupting and degrading influence, especially upon the character of those who are in the lower rungs of society, but it ruins all of society. It creates a certain arrogance and a desire, but also a deep fear. There's always this fear of trying not to be down there on that borderline. You don't want to be falling below the borderline. One of the greatest attacks that would often happen in terms of those who have been fighting racism in America for the past 400 years have been claims of being one of them, of being a lover of one of them, of the lower people. Trying to drag that person down into that lower category where they can be vilified, where they can be victimized, where they can be harmed. Creates a corrosive feeling in society where instead of reconciliation, instead of dignity of human beings, it's all about trying to prove that you're not one of the undignified. Hosea Ballou said, as to the justice of endless punishment, minds enjoying the liberty of free inquiry could easily detect the diabolical character of such justice as the exact opposite of divine nature, which is love. Such justice is evidently predicated on the false principle and ungodly practice of rendering evil for evil and of seeing some as unworthy of love. I say, from the deepest conviction of my heart, my trust both as a humanist and as a Buddhist and as a Christian, all of those resources teach me that everyone needs love. Everyone responds positively to love. And sometimes some of us need some loving correction and punishment. I met a man not too long ago who had been in prison. He had been in prison for almost 15 years. And he was part of a religious community. These people who gathered together and affirmed one another and supported one another and encouraged one another, all who knew that they were criminals, all knew that they had done something bad, but in that community, they loved one another, they accepted one another, and they believed in the possibility of goodness within each one. And the intensity and the power of that feeling was something that he wanted to carry out into the world. Out in the world, it seemed too easy to say that some people are unworthy, that some people deserve to be treated poorly and insulted and degraded and dropped down instead of brought up, raised up, reformed. And sometimes that attitude that there are someone that we can degrade or there is someone in society who's worthy of degrading, there are certain human beings who are destined to be at the bottom rungs of society, hated and kicked out and have no potential for possibilities. Sometimes that same attitude gets caught in our own souls, in our own minds, in our own lives, in the way we think of ourselves. There's a woman named Nina Campbell. She wrote a book called Freaky Freshman, which is a memoir of bullying and social anxiety. And she said, When you are victimized, at first you might wonder what you did to deserve such treatment. Nothing, probably. So that doesn't matter. What matters is that eventually the abuse becomes the status quo. It's no longer about the what's and whys. What did I do? Why are they doing this? But the whens and hows. When are they going to do it? How are they going to get me? Persecution becomes inevitable and inescapable. And once you get into that victim mindset, you are, she uses a cuss word here, ruined, in trouble, messed up. The bullies don't even need to hurt you now. Your poor, warped, pathetic brain is doing half the work for them. The Buddhist teacher Sharon Salzberg talks about meta-meditation, that when you extend loving kindness, you begin with yourself, and then move to someone that you care about, and then someone that you're neutral towards, and then towards a difficult person. And she said sometimes people have to imagine that difficult person in a difficult situation. She said there was one of the people that she was teaching who was trying to extend loving kindness towards a very loud and aggressive person in their office, and she finally imagined that person had been kidnapped and was bound and gagged, and then she could feel sorry, and then she could wish peace and well-being for that person, freedom and liberation from their suffering. And there was a lawyer that she talked about who was trying to focus on this partner. They were having an acrimonious division within their legal practice. The two lawyers were just at each other. It was very bitter. And then he went to this Buddhist retreat. And during the retreat, he was trying to do the practice of meditation, where he was extending love and kindness to this other lawyer. And he was finding himself just either irritated and restless or kind of bored of the whole practice. But when he got back after the retreat, and he walked into the office and he saw his enemy, he looked at him and he said, "It's good to see you." And he walked up and said, "How are you?" he said to him. Immediately, just spontaneously, unconsciously, was offering kindness, just as Rabbit had done to Coyote in the children's story. He literally was, and the man kind of stepped back and he goes, "Is that you?" Surprised. The two of them were changed, and the division and the dividing of the law firm went forward much more easily, with less acrimony, less pain. Thomas Merton wrote in his book, No Man is an Island, "One of the moral diseases we communicate to one another in society comes from huddling together in the pale light of an insufficient answer to a question we are afraid to ask. The insufficient answer is that we must punish people that people deserve to be degraded. And the question we are afraid to ask is, what if everyone needs love? Can we extend love and forgiveness and reconciliation to all human beings?" May it be, as Benjamin Rush said back in the early 1800s, "Universal doctrine prevails more and more in our country, particularly among persons eminent for their piety, in whom it is not a mere speculation, but a principle of action in the heart, that love prompts us to very practical goodness." So to close this service, we have a song that's printed on the purple sheet and very faint print, at least it's faint on mine. "Love knocks and waits for us to hear. Please rise in body or in spirit, to sing. Love knocks and waits for us to hear."
You have been listening to a sermon recorded at the First Unitarian Church of St. Louis.